Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Mike to New Haven podcast with sports personality Mike Colon. Here's your host, Mike Colon.
You're listening to the best of the bravest. Interviews with the FDNY's elite.
Haven't heard that theme in a while, but it's always sweet when we do. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to the Mike to New Haven podcast. This is episode 234. If you haven't checked out the previous episode yet, that was last night. Volume 27 of the E-Men inside the NYPD's emergency service unit with Joe Ocasio. Joe, originally with the New York City Transit Police, went to their rescue unit in 1992, came over to the NYPD's emergency service unit with the merge of 1995, worked in 2-truck in Harlem and later 4-truck in the Bronx. So good talking with Joe, good 18-year career with him, of course, between those departments, transit and the NYPD. So now from ESU to the FDNY for volume 33 of the best of the bravest, interviews with the FDNY's elite with my next guest who did 33 years in the FDNY, longer than that when you combine his other experience in the fire service. He'll tell us about that tonight. And coming on in 1979, when the New York City was, of course, the fire capital of the world, the next 33 years would see him work in companies like Engines 34 and 48, ladder companies 11 and 18, Battalion 18, Squad 1, and Rescue 3. Not in that order, different points, of course, but those were the companies he was in. And he was eventually able to notch the rank of battalion chief along the way before calling it a career in 2012. And that for this volume 33 of the best of the bravest interviews with the FDNY's elite is a man I've worked a long time to get. And finally, he's here, Chief John Selica. Chief, welcome. How are you?
Yes, you actually did. You finally tied me down and roped me in. Yeah. But thank you for the invitation. Great to be here.
Good to have you. So before we get in, of course, to the fire service, tell me about where you grew up.
I grew up in Mineola, out in Long Island, Nassau County. I'm a Long Island boy, and I joined the Volleys out there. That was my first taste of the fire service. Actually, gosh, I wanted to be a cop so bad. I wanted to be a Nassau cop, which is a pretty cool job out there. I went to criminal justice college and everything, but I did join the Volleys, and that sort of sidetracked me, and I got to give credit where credit is due. One of my best and closest friends back then, we haven't seen each other really for a long time now, but Richie Bonas. Richie retired from the FDNY as well, and we were good buds out there in the volunteers, and he's a guy that twisted my arm and twisted my arm and twisted my arm until I think it was the last day of filing. He said, did you ever file for the firefighter test? I said, no, I'm going to stay out. He said, let's go, and he practically forced me into filing and sending it in, and I did, and I took the test. I ended up, I'm embarrassed to say, getting on the job a year ahead of him. But the rest is history, you know, and I never did become a cop. And I thank the Lord, our God, that never did happen. I'm not sure where I would be if I ever made it to the police department. But anyway, that's where I grew up on Long Island. And then I'm sure you get a lot of other questions about a lot of other things, but that's where it all started. And it was a great place. Mineola is still a very nice little town to live in.
Oh, yeah. There's a few people that have been on the show from Mineola. Richard Teamsma, former NYPD ESU cop, bomb squad guy, Diane Macedo.
Did you say Teamsma?
Yep.
Yes, I went to high school with one of his brothers.
Yep, Rich Teamsma, good guy. Diane Macedo, who's on ABC News right now, she's a Mineola girl.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep. Yeah. So good to, you know, and of course, a bunch of other people who have yet to be on the show, but are from Mineola that I know. So of course, yeah, even though it's a little town on Long Island, it's produced a lot of notable people. So you, I guess that covers where the passion for the fire service began. And of course, working in the volleys, it's interesting. There's not a lot of paid departments out on Long Island. And you see a lot of guys that are on the volleys in the island, wherever the parts may be, Mineola, Deer Park, so on and so forth, Farmingdale, they're firemen or they're ESU cops in the city.
On the job. Tremendous amount of guys. Yep.
Exactly. And a lot of experiences that they can share with you.
Up where I live, upstate as well. A lot of guys, you know, from the volunteers are also in the city. Two hatters, you know.
Exactly. And you get a lot of great stories from them as a result. And I imagine that only heightened the desire to want to go into a paid department.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It gives you the taste for it, you know. And then, of course, you see the news and you meet people, you know, you meet guys that are on a job and that's just sort of, it just sort of takes over, you know?
Mm-hmm. What's interesting about you is that after the volleys, you went out to Florida for a little bit. I know this was during the time when there was a hiring freeze because the city was going through a financial crisis. Is that why you went out to Florida?
No. What happened was, took the test. When did I take the test? 77, graduated high school, 76, in the volley, 76, 77, 78. Took the FDNY test in 77, which eventually I got hired off of. And now we said, you know what? Look at the list number. I'm not going to get hired right away. 1668 was my list number. I remember it. And my buddy said, yeah, let's go do something. We happened to be in Florida just on one of those, you know, drinking and eating and swimming and dancing vacations. And we noticed down there that everything was paid in most of the cities that, you know, the tourists would go to. So we ended up researching it, and we looked into the Florida State Fire College, which now we're talking, it's 1977, 40, 50 years ago. It's a long time ago. You had to go to the Florida State Fire College and get a 200-hour certificate to be a paid fireman anywhere in the whole state of Florida. There's still states that don't have any minimums like that, you know? Now I think it's about 500 hours down there, but that's what we did. We packed up our stuff, went to Florida, went to the Florida Fire Academy for 200 hours, 4 weeks, got out, bought the local newspaper. And there were ads in there for firefighter tests. And we took Titusville. We took, oh, gosh, I forget what the county is around Tampa. There's a county there. But we took about three or four different tests, and we both got hired in Titusville, Florida. And that was the end of that.
Wow. We're talking with Chief John Selko. This is Volume 33 of the Best of the Bravest Interviews with the FDNY's Elite. Shout out to our friends tuning in tonight, in the chat, Jay Driscoll, William Cooney, Pete Branzo, and his better half, Raquella. Course, tuning in, Brian Keller, he's always here, and I appreciate that. Steven Zaslavsky, he's here as well. So thank you. And I think Joe Malik, I mentioned you twice, but I'll mention you again just to make sure I don't forget anybody. So working down in Florida, I know it was only 2 years, but we were talking about it off the air. The climate is interesting because it's mainly always hot, and the call volume
is
different.
Not interesting. The climate is miserable. The climate is miserable. I can't believe all these people say they love Florida. Listen, I guess if you got shorts and a T-shirt on all day and you hang out at the pool or go inside to the air-conditioned bar or whatever when you're retired. But when you're working for a living, man, hot and sweat and humidity is not fun, you know. And it was pretty tough. We used to – now, I got to tell you, my buddy and I, we were earning $11,000 a year. That was the annual salary of a Titusville Florida firefighter. So we were painting houses on the side. Don't get me wrong. We were living okay. We had a nice two-bedroom, two-bathroom, fully furnished apartment with an in-ground pool in the backyard. We both had new cars, and we were making $11,000 a year. We painted houses on the side, and we got up at like 5 in the morning. We started our jobs at 6:30, and at 11 o'clock, we closed the paint cans and went home because you couldn't paint after 11 o'clock. It was too hot, you know? So just a little some insight into the climate in Florida, you know? I did my 2 years down there.
You certainly did. Hey, to Jake Rickster in the chat, I see you. And Brian Keller says, was it Hillsborough County?
Hillsborough County is the county for Tampa. Yes, it is. Correct. Took that test as well.
Yep. So, of course, the 2 years down there, and then 79, you come back home. You talked earlier off the air about kissing the ground, considering the climate back here. I imagine when you got back to New York, you were never happier given the heat down in Florida.
You know, this is just about when people ask me what rank I like the best. I like the rank I was in. And I'm the same way with where I live. Wherever I live is where I like it, you know. But I was very, very happy to get back up to the Northeast and into the New York area. Yeah.
You know, so this is 1979. And what's interesting is the war years, the height of the war years had just really concluded. The apex of it was 1978. And that's when you saw a little bit of a tapering off. But that's not to say it still wasn't busy. There was still so much going on.
Oh,
in
yes,
the city,
it was. Oh, yes, it was.
Especially in the Bronx, especially in Brooklyn. So getting on. You know, of course, during that time, even if you had a little bit of experience, there's different ways, as I covered before. Yeah, there was the Florida way. Now you have to do things the New York City way. So tell me about that adjustment process.
You know, and actually, if you count the volunteer fire department, New York City was actually the third fire department that I joined, that I became a part of. Right. So the volunteers were Mineola was a good squared away volunteer fire department. They had companies, you know, two engine companies and a truck company. I was in the truck company, and everybody, you know, if you were in the truck, you rode the truck. If the engine was rolling out the door, it wouldn't occur to me to even get on it. You know what I'm saying? Like they were pretty organized. It was a great place. Then when I went to Titusville, same thing, small career department, three or four stations, and the staffing was not bad. I believe we had about four guys on a rig, you know, two up in the cab and two in the crew cab. And they were squared away as well. Again, not a lot of fire duty, but plenty of running around and brush fires and medical calls. And then of course, when I got to New York City, it was just like walking through the mirror. It was like being on a different planet altogether. Certainly there are some similarities. There's still SCBAs and turnout gear and responses and bosses and firefighters, but just being in New York City. Both my parents were born and raised in the city, and then, you know, got married and moved out to Long Island and started a family. So I didn't spend much time in New York other than maybe once or twice or three times a year driving in with my parents when I was just a boy going to grandma and grandpa's house, you know, up in the Bronx. But yeah, it was pretty awesome being on the job. I have to tell a quick short story, if you don't mind.
Sure, that's fine.
I always tell the story about being so excited, and it was like taking steps, you know, from the volunteers to my first career department to New York City, right? I had made it. It's like one of my friends says, it's like playing for the Yankees, you know what I'm saying? And I was so excited to walk into that firehouse, FDNY on the rig. I could smell the smoke. I could smell the diesel. It was 38th Street. I walk outside and look up. I could see the Empire State Building. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was amazing. And at the same time, 34 engine was the slowest engine in Manhattan when I got assigned to it. Slowest engine in Manhattan in 1979. And so what I like to say is, I hate to say it, but I like to say it, I was so disappointed and so excited at the same exact moment over the same issue. It was an odd feeling. You know, I eventually escaped. I got right out of there. I don't know how I did it, but I made some phone calls and made some contacts, and I got out of 34 engine in just under a year.
Because you're never going to learn that way.
Well, you know, like I wasn't thinking about learning. I was thinking about fun. I was thinking about fires. I was thinking about excitement. You know, of course, the learning happens all by itself, you know,
right,
at the same time. Yeah.
So you went to 48 after that. And 48.
No. No, I went to 11 truck after that.
Okay, 11 truck. Okay.
So this is
Alphabet City area?
Alphabet City, correct.
Okay. So working in a truck, I mean, listen, you're definitely going to get duty there because it's not just the fires. It's also, of course, the rescues. It's the ventilation process. A truck man, you know, listen, this is no disrespect to the engine men, but some of the best guys, you know, that go on to rescues, go on to SOC squads, now that SOC's been around almost a quarter century, oftentimes they come from a truck, or at least that's where they did the bulk of their career prior to rescue.
I'll tell you, I have met some of the greatest firefighters in the world out of trucks, out of engines, out of rescues, out of squads. I know guys that never worked a day outside of an engine, the engine that they got appointed to. And some of them are the absolute best guys I ever worked with, you know, totally. And of course, anybody who's listening can say the exact same words I'm saying. And I worked with occasionally here and there in all the different departments I've worked in. I worked with some of the biggest buffoons that ever strut, you know, that never worked, never strut into a firehouse. Not many. I must tell you, not many. The fire service, we're pretty lucky that most of our people are quality people. But yeah, the greatness comes in all shapes and sizes in a fire service.
Oh, of course. And that's the beauty of a firehouse. You know, you get so many different skill sets combined into one. And oftentimes, even if these guys don't have previous experience coming in the fire service, in your case, a volunteer in Long Island, of course, out in Florida, they have a background, let's say, in construction, or they have an electrical background, and they use that to their benefit in the fire service.
Oh, those are all very good to have. Very good. Yeah.
Oh, of course. Of course. Tell me about the ventilation process real quick, because there's a proper time to vent and then there's not a proper time. And each condition, depending on where the fire is and what kind of building it is different. So tell me about when and when not to ventilate.
You know, I can't tell you when and when not to, because you already said it. Every fire is different. Every compartment is different. Every body of fire, every amount of combustibles is different. The size of the room. You know, how long it's been burning? Is it in a decay stage? Is it just starting to really roar? Is there a window open somewhere else? Are flames out one window and you're getting ready to vent another window, or you can vent the first window? You know, I tell guys, I've been teaching for years on the job and after I retired, There's thousands of variables, thousands. That's why it was very good back when I was, and it was when I was an 11 truck, the job, the FDMY started controlling ventilation a little bit more. You had to give your company a shout inside. If you were the outside vent firefighter, the outside vent man, the OVM, you had a call, 1-1 OV to 1-1, and your officer would answer you from inside the fire department. I'm getting ready to take the windows, Lou, and he'd say, hold up, or he'd say, go ahead. Before that, you would just get to your position, and out that window would come. And whatever happened, and they would deal with it, and you would deal with it. So, you know, that's the best I can say. Is there more to it than that? Yeah, I'm certainly not the sharpest guy, you know, in town on science and flow paths and all this other stuff. But it's quite complex, yet the variables are innumerable.
I definitely hearken back to something Hank Malay told me the first time he was on the show last year, of course, out of Rescue 1 and Squad 288, where he said, a good roof man can be worth his weight in gold. Because, of course, and same applies to ventilation, of course, because if you cut that roof too early, either from inside the building or on the roof, of course, it can cause problems. But it's not only that and knowing when to do it. Sometimes it's spotting things from that angle that the engine man can't spot because he's busy fighting the fire, or guys on the ground can't spot too. I mean, listen, if there's somebody that's trapped but you can't see him, anything that the average firefighter on the ground might miss, that's where the roof man comes in or the ventilation man comes in. And that's how the operation can really go a heck of a lot smoother when that roof man or even roof woman knows what he or she is doing.
Right. The roof firefighter, very, very true. And what's great about it is, you know, every fire department doesn't have a roof firefighter. New York City, because we're fortunate that it's a big city and it supports its fire department adequately with staffing. And there's a firefighter assigned the roof in every truck company, and that's where he goes. And it's a priority. Like he's got to walk past other things that need to get done and not do them because he's got to get to the roof. And when he gets to the roof, you've already said it. You've outlined a few of the things they do. He can find a fire for you. You know, I've heard, as a roof firefighter myself at a couple of different companies, I've had the chief call me and say, what's the conditions up there? You know, how's the roof look? Should you guys be up there, you know, if there wasn't an officer? And often in the FDNY, there is no officer on the roof initially. There's a couple of roof firefighters. Maybe an outside vent firefighter will show up there. Maybe if a rescue or a squad shows up, they might have a team of people that show up. So you can have four or five or six firefighters on the roof of a tenement or a taxpayer and no lieutenant and no captain. So, and the chief knows that. So a chief can call up there and say, hey, how does it look? You guys get that roof open yet? You know, so I had that happen to myself a couple of times, a couple of jobs. I had to give them a second yell and say, hey, guys on the top floor are screaming for relief, man. You guys get that hole done yet? You know?
Before we continue, like I said, it's volume 33 of the best, the bravest interviews with the FDNY's elite with battalion chief, retired battalion chief, John Sulka. Gary Stadler has a question. I don't know if you know what he's referring to, but he wants to know about the Sammy story.
Oh, that's pretty funny. Okay, so I go to 11 truck from 34 engine, and I get down there, and it's rocking and rolling. It's a great place, and everybody down there, it's just a great place. It's busy. Everybody's got great personalities and great stories, and I introduce myself, and they call me Sammy. I said, no, my name's John. They said, no, not anymore. They said, we got 9 Johns down here. We're not having 10, you know, so you're going to be Sammy. And I swear, it was like we just turned a page of a book. Okay. And from then on, everybody called me Sammy, and my head would turn when somebody said that. My wife, and then she became my then we got engaged, and then we got married. For the years that I was in 11 truck, she called me Sammy at home and off duty. And to this day, if I go to a reunion with 11 truck, guys will say, hey, Sammy, how you doing? You know, and that's just, it's just stuck. It's an odd story, but it's true.
Not a bad nickname to have. There's been worse. Yeah. Hey, Sammy. Sammy's still a nice ring to it.
There's a lot worse things they can call you than Sammy.
Yeah, that's true. And I know it's skipping ahead a bit, but it's a good question. It comes from a fellow Mike Thomas. It says, hey, Chief, were you involved with building the new all-5 rescue company rigs after 9-11 in 2002, 2003?
Nothing to do with it. After 9-11, I was a battalion chief 6 years on 9-11, and I stayed in the 18th Battalion for however many years I stayed until 2012. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mike, for submitting the questions.
Thanks, Mike.
And no problem. Good man, Mike Thomas. He's always tuning in. So thank you very much for, like I said, submitting that question. So, of course, working in 11 and really in any ladder company, like I said before, it's not, and engine companies can go to these too. That's not to diminish them, like I said earlier. It's not just the fires. There's other non-fire emergencies that you can go to. I mean, of course, there's the elevator accidents, construction accidents, car accidents. So with that being said, obviously you're not happy these things are happening because it means people have gotten hurt. Or, you know, I can mention a building collapse too. But whenever these jobs would come over the radio, what's the one that you said, all right, we're going to really do some work here that wasn't a fire-related emergency?
You know, we had some pretty good collapses down there over the years. Not a lot of them. Not a lot of them. But the Lower East Side is an old, old neighborhood. Lower East Side was there. Most of those buildings were there when there were horse-drawn carriages going up and down the streets, delivering milk and groceries and stuff like that. It's an old, old neighborhood. So the buildings are old. They've been there a long time. And occasionally you get an old tenement either fall in on itself or fall on a taxpayer next door. So collapses are always interesting. And because of the location, the geographical location of the Lower East Side, obviously on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, we were a long way away from Rescue 1. Rescue 1 had to drive a long way to get to the Lower East Side for a collapse. There were no squads back then. There was Squad 1 in Brooklyn, which I later became a lieutenant at. But there wasn't Squad 18 and Squad 2, you know, all these other squads all over the job. So when there was a special unit operation, it was Rescue 1 coming from up on 43rd Street on the west side of Manhattan. So places like 11 truck and 18 truck and 6 truck on the Lower East Side and others, you know, if we got to a collapse, we were doing the work. We were doing the work for the first 20 or 15, you know, minutes until, you know, rescue got there and maybe a deputy came in and started to organize things a little bit better. So it was always very interesting and exciting to go to, you know, and there was no real small collapses back then. Those buildings are so old. Once they started falling down, the whole dang thing fell down, you know. So that was always interesting.
And with that being said, I think this was before, obviously, this is well before the Special Operations Command, like you were saying. This was before 13 David, too. You guys didn't have 13 David yet either in those days.
No, that all happened when I was a lieutenant. That all happened. That's when I created SOC. As a matter of fact, the story is, you know, so I leave 11 truck and I go to Rescue 3 eventually as a firefighter. And I stay there for several years and studying for lieutenant. I was already studying when I was a lieutenant. And I make I make a list, John Norman, Jay Jonas, myself, a bunch of us up there got promoted.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Never heard of
it. Say again?
Never heard of them. I'm just kidding, of course.
They're all good friends of mine.
Of course.
So I leave Rescue 3 now and get promoted. Where did I go? I went back to the 1st Division, and I ended up landing a spot in 18 truck, which is literally blocks away from 11 truck. They're 1st and 2nd due to each other. And one day when I was sitting in the office, I got my front piece right over there. One day when I was sitting in the office, I got a phone call from Tony Lindbergh. Tony Lindbergh was a rescue guy. He was a lieutenant. I guess he was working light duty or whatever. And he said, hey, Lieutenant Selke, we're starting a new command, a special operations command. We're going to have all the rescues and squad company and I think the boats too and stuff. He said, we're looking for guys to, not for spots. He said, you're not going to come in and get a spot, but if you come in and cover in the rescues, eventually maybe you will get a spot. And you know what I did? I gave up my spot in 18 truck and I went covering again in SOC. And I worked in Rescue 5, Rescue 4, Rescue. I worked in all the rescues, Squad 1, and wherever else they put me for, you know, a year or two. Until eventually I ended up getting assigned to Squad 1 in Brooklyn.
So going to Rescue 3, just to go back for a second as a fireman, speaking of collapse, Rescue 3, as I covered when John Norman was on the show back in May, they really are the originators and masters of collapse rescue because now every borough has one. They have the collapse rescue rig, but back then Rescue 3 was the first, Big Blue, of course, in addition to all the other emergencies they were going to. So in a firehouse like that, there's so much to learn from and so many people to learn from as well. I think Conrad Tinney was there, for example, during this time. Lots of
Absolutely.
Great guys.
Conrad Tinney's a great man.
I think he went on to be a fire marshal later on. So just tell me about working in three, and not just working in three, but being able to pick up so much in regards to technical rescue for a company that, like I said, was really on the forefront of modernizing what is today a 21st century technical rescue.
Right. I mean, I guess you could have called it technical rescue back then, but nobody really would have known what you're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. There was really no rescue school back then. When you got picked by the captain and you waited your turn and there was a slot and there was an opening, boom, you're in rescue. You get trained in a firehouse, you work shifts, you're there on an onion skin or a detail for a while. And if you measure up and you're doing good and you're learning, they keep you. And if you're not, out the door you go. So right. My point is, it wasn't highly technical and highly a big training. There wasn't a big training element like there is now. You go join a rescue or squad company now, you're going to go to the rescue school. It's weeks and weeks long out at the Rock, taught by, you know, some of the most experienced, most senior people in the squads and the rescues. And we didn't have that back then. We, you know, technical rescue, collapse rescue was in its infancy. Our collapse rig was one of the spare rescue rigs. They brought it to Rescue 3. And what do? We loaded some extra tools on there, some sheets of plywood, a couple extra saws and stuff like that. There was no real highly technical stuff. It quickly evolved into that. And of course, they covered the whole city. Rescue 3 and the collapse rig covered the whole city. So what was good about that was they got a lot of experience doing it. Now each rescue has their own. They just cover their own borough. So each rescue does a lot less collapse work now because they only have their own response area. You know,
I was going to say, why? I guess that covers it. Why did the Bronx get it particularly?
You know what? I don't know. And not to say that it is or was, but it certainly could have been. It depends on who's in charge. I don't know who the chief of rescue services was. I don't know who the other people were that were in the new command, the special operations command. But certainly those folks probably had a great influence on who it was going to be. To me, it seemed a little odd. Rescue 3 was sort of so far out of the ballpark. They were way up in the Bronx. It was a long trip to most parts of Brooklyn or something like that. But that's the way it evolved. And we were pretty happy about it.
Of course, this is volume 33, The Best of the Bravest, interviews with the FDNY's elite. Like I said, Chief John Selk is the guest tonight. And a few more questions in the chat here. First from Rob Procaccini, who's on the job in Stamford, Connecticut, right by New York City, of course. He says, what was the rescue liaison?
The rescue liaison. Let me try and remember what the rescue liaison. The rescue liaison was, I think it was a car. It was like a battalion car. It was a response car, but it was a captain. It wasn't a battalion chief. It was a captain. And they would respond sort of like the rescue battalion does. So let's call it the earlier version or the farm team version of the now rescue battalion, which is a great resource. Yeah.
Well, of course. Okay. So there you go. Thanks for explaining that. And another question from Mike Thomas. Interesting one. He says, hey, Chief, where was Rescue Company 3 when you were there as a firefighter? Which firehouse? Because they've moved a few times.
Yes. It was in 181st Street in Manhattan. So it was a Rescue 3. 45 truck, 93 engine, and the 1-3 battalion. 20 guys, 20 on-duty firefighters and officers sat down to dinner in that firehouse. It was quite a show, you know. And if a local box came in, everybody went. Everybody went. And the traffic on that block, 181st Street, was horrendous. If you stood in front of quarters at any one moment during daylight, you could probably visually look at and see 11, that's 1-1, 11 city buses on the street, stacked up with hundreds of cars in between. Sometimes the second new engine would beat 93 to their home box because of the gridlock. No negative connotation to 93 engine. Don't get me wrong, it was a great company, but right. It was terrible. It was they were so happy to get out of it. I got promoted. They were still there. They moved to the Bronx after that. They went to 27 trucks, old quarters, 46 and 27. They refurbed that. They stayed there for many years. And now, of course, they got their beautiful Taj Mahal on Washington Avenue.
They most certainly do. The budget's gone up. And Darren Phillips says, 20 guys, imagine that kitchen table.
Well, it wasn't a kitchen table. It was either three. Let me think. One, two. I think it was either three or four kitchen tables. It was quite a crowd. Yeah.
Right, for sure. A few more people tuning in the chat. Look who's here, Hank Millay. He says, that's exactly correct to your earlier
point. There he is.
Hey, Hank. Good to see you, Hank. And Paul Rogers, who was in hazmat for a long time, he wants to know, Chief, did you ever work in hazmat? Hey, Paul, good to see you.
You know what? I worked in hazmat when I was covering in SOC, when I was the new junior guy, when I was just a covering lieutenant. And listen, I know hazmat's necessary. I know it's important. I know those guys are probably three times or four times smarter than me. I had some friends that worked there. It just seemed like every time we got on that rig, and or two rigs, you responded to a call. It was two rigs. I forget how many guys we had, 7 or 8 or 9 or something. I don't think we got to half of the boxes, you know what I'm saying? Because something would get called or you know, the importance of it would get scaled down, or a chief would be on the scene and say, okay, we got it. We discovered what it was and stuff like that. Most of the stuff was, I don't want to say above my head, but it was just, I had less of an interest in hazmat, but I worked many a tour there when I was covering, because you work where they send you, and that's part of the job of being a covering officer.
And to your point earlier, Hank adds, also, we didn't have the rescue school back then, like you said, but we didn't do building inspections. So every day we were out drilling on what is now technical rescue stuff.
Right, right. Listen, we had that stuff when I was in Rescue 3. We had the grip hoist, and we had the old roof rope, and we had all sorts of rescue equipment. The word technical just never came out of our mouths. It was just heavy rescue equipment. And of course,
right,
we all know how to do it. We had the airbags and we had the jacks and we had all sorts of stuff. It was interesting stuff. But it's just a sort of a wording difference between saying technical rescue and just maybe heavy rescue tools, you know?
Yeah, same thing, different terminology. This is jumping ahead a little bit, but again, it's a good question. CFD 335, 346 says, Seneca Taldo, original Squad 1 legend. Does the chief have any stories about him?
I certainly do. Seneca Taldo was my mutual partner. I love Sonny. What a great guy. And Sonny was one of the original members of the squad. I got a great picture of him somewhere when he was, he had a goatee when he was, before he got into the squad. And Sonny was a senior guy. I was just a BOP lieutenant, even when I got to the squad, you know. And Sonny was a senior guy. He was a gentleman. He was smart. I know he must have yelled at somebody, but I never heard him raise his voice or yell at anybody. He was very, very well respected. I'll tell a short story about that. So I go to a funeral for Kenny Pogan. Kenny Pogan was a very well-known member of Squad 1. And eventually went out to Staten Island, and he was an aide and retired. Kenny Pogan had surgery. Something happened. He died a couple of days later. I think he bled out or something happened. I don't remember, but it was an unexpected. He passed away unexpectedly. I loved Kenny Pogan. He scared the shit out of me when he was driving. But other than that, I apologize for that. So I go to his wake, and his boy is there. His boy's I don't think he was a lieutenant yet. I think he was still a firefighter in 3 truck. And I was sitting in the parking lot early because I drove a long way to get there. I wasn't sure how long it was going to take. And he came over, and we knew each other. Hey, Chief, how you doing? Good. You know, we went aside to talk. And then all the squad guys started showing up because he was very popular, Kenny. And about an hour into it, Sonny Cataldo shows up in his dress uniform. Now, this wasn't 10 years ago, or maybe it was. I was probably in my 50s. He was probably maybe 80 years old. And Sonny comes in with his wife, and all the guys crowding around him and greeting him and saying hello. And finally, when the crowd dispersed a little bit, I walked up and put my hand out. And Sonny grabbed my hand and looked at me. And he had a confused look on his face. He really, my heart was breaking. He really didn't know who I was. Now, I was his mutual partner for just a couple of years. And then I was gone. And 20 years went by, you know. He did remember me. He said, John, right, John? I said, John Salka. Oh, that's right, John. And, you know, eventually we said hello. We hugged each other. But it was a great story because Sonny was there for everything, boy. He was there when it started, and he was there for a lot of great times in the squad.
Yep. And Hank wants to know, he's like, wasn't he an Engine 269 guy before they were Squad 1?
You know what? I can't answer that. I can't answer if he was 269. Obviously, that's the Firehouse 269.
Right.
But I don't know if Sonny was. I don't know if Sonny was in that place before.
Yeah. And Gary Stadler's asking, you know, because you were in Squad 1 during the 90s, if I'm not mistaken, right?
You know what? That's another thing that I don't remember very well. People ask me all the time, oh, so what years were you in the squad? What years were you? I don't remember. I don't remember every year. I just remember that I was a fireman, then I was a lieutenant, then I was a captain. And, you know, if I counted backwards, I could probably tell you that. But, yeah, somewhere in the 90s. Yeah. Yeah.
So he wants to know basically what it was like during that time.
You know what was great about the squad back then was there was no EMS. So we were just a squad. We were just first due in the neighborhood. In our first due, we weren't second due. We weren't third due. We weren't fourth due. We didn't have any BI, building inspection. We didn't check hydrants. All we did was go first due boxes, which were always fun, first due, no matter. And we had a job now and then, or 1075s in the battalions that we were assigned to. And it was heaven. It was heaven. Yeah. I remember once or twice working a 24-hour tour and not having a run. People are like, oh man. I said, well, that means nobody in all those battalions had a 1075 for the 24 hours, you know? So hey, we'll other than that, it. We went out the door a couple of times. Now, what was great was, and of course you probably shouldn't have done it, or I probably shouldn't have done it, but back then I'd be laying up in bed or I'd be up in the office in the middle of the afternoon doing something. And of course the radio was always on, you know, everywhere. A lot of firehouses, not only squadron rescues, but you know, busy trucks and engines do it as well. And I'd hear the Brooklyn dispatcher saying, you know, Brooklyn to battalion, whoever, 4-8, getting a bunch of calls. Sounds like you're going to work. I'd ring the bell, say, let's go, squad. We're going. And we'd turn out, even though we weren't assigned yet, knowing that we were going to be, you know. Years later, when you had EMS, you really couldn't do that because you couldn't drive 20 blocks, 30 blocks away to go to a job that you were hoping to get called to, because you could get a, you know, you could get a cardiac call or an EMS call and you'd be out of position for it. And I'm sure that wouldn't go over very well.
Yeah. Now it changed a lot. There's some, as I've covered before, there's some benefits to now sending the FDNY on CFRD runs. And I got to actually ask that to Howard Safer when he was on the show a little while ago. And yeah, I guess there is a drawback in that sense, even though you're happy to save some money in a cardiac, don't get me wrong. Those jobs previously that you can go to, there's a wistfulness, there's a nostalgia because you can't quite do that anymore, like you said.
Right. And the rescues do that. Rescue 2 did that. Rescue 2 used to go out patrol. And I know that they used to drive around and sometimes they hit it right. Sometimes they're in the right neighborhood when a job came in and they didn't have to drive, you know, 60 blocks to get there.
Mm, yeah. Rescue 2, the rescue, of course, the rescue. We can't not refer to them as their proper name. Of course, I got that in The Last Man Out. It was funny seeing that because it would irritate all the other rescues. Why are they calling themselves the rescue? I know Hank must have felt about some type of way about that in one. But nevertheless, I love Rescue 2. And there was actually a great job that they did. They actually assisted Rescue 1 the other day. There's a clip of it on my buddy Mark Rubin's channel. Check it out if you haven't, where they're assisting Rescue 1 at a dive job, actually. So great company, citywide company, in addition to, of course, all the great work they do in Brooklyn. So
I remember doing an interesting job in Rescue 2. I was covering Rescue 2 one day. It was a day tour in the middle of the summer. And we got a dive job. And it was down off of where were we? We worked off of Brooklyn. It was a pier in Brooklyn. Apparently, the NYPD, either the dive people or the harbor people, they were filming some type of either a commercial or a promotional thing or a recruitment video, and they were doing a simulated rescue of an officer in the water who was pretending to be a civilian in the water, and a helicopter came and the guys jumped into the water, and one of the cops went down. One of the cops went under. And they, of course, it turned into a big, big rescue operation. We responded. They never let us in the water. My guys stood on that pier in full scuba gear, and they never let them in the water. And that guy died. That cop died. They had to pull his body out of the water later on that day.
Ken Hansen, 1991. Yeah, that was Kenny Hansen, I think was his name.
Yep, it was a tragic incident, you know.
Right. Let me look it up just to make sure I have the guy's name right.
I don't remember the details except that we stood on that pier for a long time, and my guys were, you know, the guys from Rescue 2 were chomping at the bit. They wanted to get in the water and help, and the PD did not accept our assistance.
Yeah, it was him, Kenny Hansen, June 11th, 1991 here. He drowned while posing as a victim during a water rescue training session.
Yep.
He was reported missing, and his body was recovered the next day. 26 years old. So sad.
Very tragic. Yep.
Very tragic indeed. Ruth Ann Griffin, yeah, Kenny Hansen. You know, she would know because her dad was an E-man. Leo Griffith worked in truck. Did your dad work in truck 7, Ruth Ann? I think he worked in truck 7, if I remember correctly. And Hank Malay says about Rescue 2. They're like Avis. They try harder because they're number 2.
I love you, Hank. I love you.
So just to go back to a second to your career, of course, you know, getting to lieutenant, later captain, later battalion chief. As it progressed throughout, you know, did you always want to go up in the ranks as soon as he came on, or was it something that over time, you know, you said, you know what, because like you said earlier, you could stay a fireman your whole career and have a great time, but was it something that came to you as you were in the middle of your career in the FDNY and said, you know what, I ought to try this?
Right. I can tell you from the day I got on the fire department, I knew I was going to try and get up there. I can't say I knew I was going to be a chief. I certainly wanted to. I remember going to my either 20th or 30th reunion. We had it in a bar somewhere in Manhattan. There was only about 18 or 20 guys there. We only had a 60-man class, but there was about 20 guys there. And at the end, we were posing for pictures and kidding around and telling stories. And a bunch of the guys were ribbing me a little bit, saying, yeah, we used to call you the chief in Proby school. Well, you knew you were going to be a chief, you know. So whether they really knew that or not, I don't know. Whether they were blowing smoke, I don't know. But you're right what you said. Whatever you choose to do is the best thing. I am thankful that there are guys that were senior firefighters in the rescue in a squad. You had to see the crew of guys I had in squad one when I was an officer there. It was amazing. You know, Timmy Rogers and you know, Kenny Pogan and guys that were just fantastic, that were firemen for 20, 30 years. And I don't care who you are, what kind of officer you are, you'll never get the experience that a 30-year firefighter has, handling tools and going to fires, you know. On the other hand, I had no seniority in any rank until I made battalion chief. I made battalion chief for 17 years. So I did fireman, lieutenant, and captain in 17 years. And then I did another 17 years as a battalion chief. I finally became – I had a little seniority in one rank, you know. So I enjoyed it. And I'll save you the trouble of asking me the question. What rank did you enjoy the most? The answer is every one. Whatever rank I was in, I enjoyed. I love being an 11 truck. When I pulled up the anchor and went to Rescue 3, that was like getting on a new fire department. That was great. You know, I left Rescue 3 when I got promoted, like John Norman did and Jay Jonas and the rest of us. It was hard to leave there, but we knew what we wanted to do. And we got promoted and went bouncing and, you know, did this and did that. Everybody went in different directions. And, I'm glad I did it. It was an experience that was worthwhile.
And I think there's something that Dennis Tardio mentioned to me when I interviewed him last year. And he was a captain on the job a long time. And it stuck with me. He's like, you know what? As you ascend, not to say that the job isn't difficult, but in terms of being a command presence, a commanding officer in the New York City Fire Department, it gets easier because lieutenant's the rough adjustment. Lieutenant's the, because obviously that's the first rank that you have as a fire officer. But the higher you get, the better you get at being able to have a command presence and knowing what to do and, more importantly, what not to do as a leader.
So true, especially the way the New York City Fire Department, the command structure, the way it's structured, the way it's put together, it's fantastic. You know, and I travel around the country teaching and writing and lecturing, and a lot of places have, well, some places have similar, some places are different. Some places, every company got captains. Every shift, every unit is a captain. There's three captains in Engine 2, depending on whether the ABC shift is working. Every day is a captain. I said, who decides where the rolled-ups go? Who decides if we're going to carry the Halligan on this side of the rig or that side of the rig? Well, each lieutenant or captain decides on his own day. And the way New York City has it set up, and it's been that way set up for a long time, you're exactly correct. It did become easier. Lieutenant's hard. You know, it's the first one that you're not sitting in the back with the boys. You know, you're sitting in the front now. And then when you make captain, it's like, been there, done that. I know how to ride the front seat. I know how to tell guys what to do. Then when you make battalion chief, what's great is you were a captain and you were a lieutenant. So you know who you're talking to. You talk a little differently to a young lieutenant than you do to maybe a seasoned captain or even a brand new captain. A brand new captain is not brand new anything. He's been an officer probably for 5 or 6 years as a lieutenant, you know? So
yeah, just a different.
Yeah, you're right. It's right. You're right. It's not easy, but it gets easier as you go up, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, and especially when you have the great guys that you had working under you, it gets especially easy. It's
camera. And that's the real answer. And that's the real answer because you have such quality people in the fire department in New York. Firefighters and company officers, you know, and I don't really mean this, but a lot of fires I went to, I could have not got there. And they probably would have ended very similarly because the people, the firefighters and the officers, they just know what they're doing. And that's not true in every fire department. And that's not true in every rank in every fire department. But I'll tell you what, all my years on the job, I could count on one hand and not use all the fingers, the guys that I met or worked with that didn't know what they were doing. Everybody else knew what they were doing. And it's that's a highly, highly, you know, treasured skill, you know.
And that's the biggest compliment I think you can pay the profession as a whole, that the incompetency rate is so, so, so low, maybe even under 1%.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty,
and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Right. And the greatest compliment you can get as a firefighter is, he's a good, in the old days, he's a good fireman, or he's a good firefighter, right? That's the ultimate compliment. You know?
Yeah, no, of course. And to your point earlier about Harbor, this is something Hank mentioned. I guess this is when he was in Rescue One, I should say. We had a tourist helicopter go down in the East River with six people on board. Patty Brown, the late, great Patty Brown, was the officer in Rescue One. I was one of the divers fully geared, and a PD Harbor captain wouldn't let us dive. He said it was a crime scene. All passengers, unfortunately, died. They had no divers on scene at that time. I still have the news articles. Hopefully those days are gone now. And I can tell you that they are, Hank, knowing the PD side of operations and FD, because something like that, if you were to do that today on either side, FD or PD, you would be fired and maybe even arrested. Right?
Fired. You might go to jail. That was exactly. The Battle of the Badges. I remember when I was in the squad, some fireman in Brooklyn somewhere, some truck guy was in handcuffs. I remember seeing the picture, a helmet and a coat, and his hands were behind his back. He was in handcuffs. I can't remember if it was an extrication, you know, a Hearst tool job, or if it was something else, but that was when we were just battle. I remember hearing a firefighter say to a battalion chief in the Bronx one night, I was in the rescue as a firefighter, and this ESU cop said to the chief, you know, F that word to a battalion chief, get out of here. This is our job, you know. And I was astounded that a patrolman would say that to a boss in a fire department, you know.
Right. But anyway. No, of course.
They are gone. Everything's very good in the field now.
Oh, by the time that your career ended, I imagine you guys got along swimmingly, and all that nonsense, all that needless fighting was long gone by the time.
Certainly that didn't happen. Where you had people standing by, not using them when somebody was dying in the water. You know,
exactly. Right. And shame on that harbor captain. I hope he never lived that down, because six.
I remember that Jane. What was it? Jane Dornacker? What was a news cop that was down, right? Rescue Paul One took that job.
Yeah, Paul Hassigan made the rescue there.
Yes.
Yep, because she worked for WNBC, of course, as delivery Don Imus used to say. Yeah, no, and, you know, it's good. I think what's helped a lot, last note on that, was, of course, FEMA, because now you got all these guys from ESU, as I covered before, and the rescues of the FDNY teaming up to where now they work those jobs hand in hand just fine, either in other parts of the country or other parts of the world. You bring them back here, they see each other on a job. Hey, how you doing? You know what? And they're working
hand in
hand.
They're breaking the barriers down a little bit. Yep.
Yeah, that was such a great thing. And Joe Maliga says here, did the chief ever work a job or jobs where the super pumper was utilized?
No. But when I first got on a job, I did make my way over there and got a picture of me standing in front of it. So I can say I was on a job with the super pumper, but I never did work with one. No.
And a couple more questions from Mike Thomas. He's had, and you guys are really submitting some good questions. You're making my work easy tonight. Speaking of being a lieutenant, and you know, of course, your job's easier because you have great guys working under you. The audience is doing a great job tonight. Mike Thomas has too. He says, did you work on the TV show Third Watch? And what was it like working on Chicago Fire? And did they film at Ten House?
Okay, so no, I did not work at Third Watch. And yes, I did work at Chicago Fire, and they did film it at the Ten House. It was pretty interesting. My good buddy, Steve Chikorotis, I don't know if you know Steve. Steve's from retired deputy district, I think, chief from Chicago, and he's the technical editor. He's quite an important person on the staff over there, the staff at Chicago Fire. He called me up one day and said, hey, you know what? We're doing an episode in New York. We're going to shoot right in downtown. Would you be interested? I said, sure. You know, so make a long story short, I had to go down and read the lines and punch the ticket and go through the motions. But I got the job. It was a very, very short little piece. And then when the day arrived, my daughter went down with me, and we went to the Third Watch. Third Watch has some studios down there at the old U.S. United States lines. The old United States lines. Now that's like some TV stuff going on there. So we met there. And they brought us down to Ten House in a little caravan of vehicles. If I remember correctly, we did 20, maybe 30. And I'm not criticizing them at all, because they're artists and they're professionals and they know what they're doing. I think we did 20 or 30 takes for a scene that was about a minute long, you know. but it was great. And Steve did a great job. And I'm telling you, the big stars there, Chief, what's his name? B with a B, the chief on Chicago Fire. I can't think of his name.
Bowden. Yeah.
Him and the other two guys, that like the two lead lieutenants, I think one of them's a captain now on the show.
Yeah.
They treated me like I was the star that day. They just were very nice and friendly, and everybody in the crew was very nice. And, you know, they got my daughter up on a director's chair watching everything on a screen. And we had a great time. It was a great, you know, it was a great half a day to get a minute on the air, you know?
Yeah. I mean, for me, nothing against them. I know they're probably great actors. They're great at what they do. I just can't with those shows. Like, even now, I'm a huge Law & Order guy, but Special Victims Unit and Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, I'm like, that would never happen. The more I talk to you, the more I say that. You'll talk to you guys in the FD and of course, in the PD as well. I'm like, they wouldn't do it that way.
I say the same thing when I'm watching with my wife. I was looking at something recently. I can't remember what show it was, but I was like, I can't believe this is it. I'm going in the kitchen to get something to drink. I said, I can't even look at this. It was just, you know, and I was always the guy telling guys in the firehouse about Third Watch and all these other shows that came on over the years. I said, don't get upset over it. It's just entertainment. You know, they used to, hey, Chief, is that the Third Watch? And there was another one. What was the other one? The other fire show that was right in New York. It was supposed to be
Rescue Me.
York. Huh?
Rescue Me.
Chief, is that Rescue Me? Is that real? I said, the uniform. The uniforms are real. I said, that's it. The uniforms. Nothing else is real. Just enjoy it, you know? Yeah. Oh, I know what it was. We were watching Fire Country, that brand new show that's on Friday nights or Sunday. It's all about the Cal Fire. Yeah. And I don't know anything about Cal Fire, but I know that the woman, the chief on there, her collar pins are upside down. I'm watching the show, and I said, she's got like a deputy chief trumpets, and both of them are upside down every episode. I still can't believe that they haven't corrected that yet, you know?
You got to write them. If they have an email, of course, reach out to them so they can they'll listen. They'll fix it. And to your point earlier about that great job that Hashtag and the guys from Rescue One did on that Jane Dornacker incident, William Pate, Hank says, was the pilot. He'd send a card every year. I think he became a lawyer, too, after that.
Oh, okay.
I'm not mistaken. He became an Esquire. Gary Stadler comes with another question. He says, ask the chief about Lieutenant Billy McGinn, a.k.a. College Boy.
Billy McGinn, you're going to make me cry.
He died on 9/11, right?
Billy McGinn was one of my dear friends, and he died on 9/11. Yeah. So I'm an 11 truck, and I'm absolutely the hottest thing in the world now. I came from 34. I'm an 11 truck. I'm there for like a year, and I'm like Fireboy now, you know? McGinn shows up, Proby. And he comes walking in, and he's got his college degree in whatever, engineering, microbiology, space travel, something. I don't know what it was, but he comes in, and he's a very cool dude, Billy McGinn. Very quiet, not real talkative. And I jumped right on him. Like, one day he walked into the kitchen, he put the bagels down, he took his coat and hat up, he sat down. And I was like, what are you doing? He said, I'm going to sit down and have a bagel. I said, go check the rig. You're the Bob today. You're the Johnny, you know. And I was all over him, like you know, a mess. Make a long story short, forward fast, we ended up getting to be friendly with each other and actually becoming good friends. And as the years unfolded, I eventually left 11, went to Rescue 3, and made lieutenant. Billy left 11 and went up to Squad 41 at the time when it was Enhanced Engine 41. He didn't stay there because of all the political nonsense that was happening. He went back to 11, but by then I was lieutenant where? Squad 1. Mm-hmm. I invited him over. He came to Squad 1 with me. I got promoted out of Squad 1, eventually went to 48 Engine. Billy got promoted out of Squad 1 as a firefighter to lieutenant. And where did Billy McGinn go as a lieutenant? 48 Engine. He was one of my lieutenants in 48 Engine. So we were in 11 truck, Squad 1, and 48 Engine together. And then he left with Andy Fredericks and a couple other guys, and they went to Squad 18 when they formed them. And I got promoted out of 48 Engine, and it was still the same number. I ended up in the 18th Battalion, so we still had the same number in our last unit. But, yeah, I miss Billy. I think about him all the time. Billy McGinn was a good, good man.
Yeah, I knew someone. Well, I'm friendly with Irma Rivera, who's a retired NYPD homicide detective who lived on the same block as him. And she said, yeah, our kids will play together. Same thing you just said. Very nice, soft-spoken guy and very surprised. You know, she told me when, you know, she learned that he had died because of how good of a fireman, how experienced of a fireman he was, you know.
Yep.
You know,
Billy McGinn said on the radio, and you can look it up. I've heard it a number of times. He said it on a department radio when he was responding with Squad 18 to the World Trade Center. He described, he said, that plane appeared to have blown straight into the building and, you know, advise everybody that this could be a terrorist attack. Billy McGinn said that on the department radio that day. He was ahead of his time.
Yeah, and speaking of, you mentioned Andy Fredericks, and there's a guy I would have loved to have chronicled on this show because I still go back, and it was, you know, he called it perfectly back in 1999, 2000. You probably know what I'm going to bring up. Don't worry about that nozzle anymore, kid. We don't fight fires. That speech, that's it. For those of you that have never watched that speech, I highly suggest you do because, man, was he ahead of his time with that.
Andy was a great guy, and he took a lot of ribbon for it, too, in 48 Engine when he was a fireman there because he was – I don't want to call him a genius, but he was enlightened. He was a bright, bright guy. He understood firefighting and all the technical aspects of it and the theory behind it. And a lot of other guys just came to work and just pulled their way through it and got it done. And they were good, strong firefighters. But Andy just was real bright. And sometimes their guys would bust his chops unmercifully over, you know, the words that he would use and stuff like that. He wasn't an elitist or anything, but he was great. He was great. He would have been a great boss, too.
Right. This is Volume 33, The Best, The Bravest Interviews with the FDNY's Elite. We're talking with retired Battalion Chief John Sulko. There had to be a part of you, because you mentioned 17 years, you eventually got to that rank as chief. So that would take us up to 1995, 1996, where you're saying to yourself, I mean, you're not being braggadocious, obviously, you're not being haughty, but there is pride in that. Wow, I don't even have 20 years and I'm already a chief. And you're still such a young guy with still so much in your career left to go because you didn't have any desire to retire at that point.
Well, you know what? Making battalion chief for 17 years was, I mean, other people can tell me what it was, you know, whether it was amazing or not, or you know, it wasn't unprecedented or anything. I mean, obviously it was pretty young back in those days, but frankly, once you make battalion chief with 17 years, there's a lot of stress associated with that because now you're this young guy amongst a lot of other senior people, senior lieutenants, senior captains, and very senior battalion chiefs. Every battalion chief I ever knew in my life had gray hair. And suddenly I'm this young guy with 17 years on the job and I'm wearing this white hat. So, you know, it wasn't easy and I'm certainly not complaining. I worked really hard, you know, for every promotion I got along with people like Jay Jonas and Ralph Fago and Billy Byer. We had a superb study group and we all did really well for ourselves. But it was pretty tough getting promoted early. There was a lot of eyes on you as there should be in the FDNY. There's a lot of eyes on new officers all the time. And I sort of followed suit. As a captain and later as a battalion chief, I watched the young lieutenants and tried to help them out and give them advice or direction or whatever I had to give them. So it was a pleasure and I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I studied and I'm glad I studied early. But there was some stress related to being a young officer as well.
Mm-hmm. And especially after 9/11, when so many chiefs, so much of that experience was lost, that added the pressure, you know, that added to it tenfold to where now at that point you had 22, 23 years on the job. If you combine, of course, the volleys in Florida, 25, they're looking at you like, okay, now you got to step up. You can't replace those guys, but you got to put your best forward so that the department can keep going.
Right. And also what happened after 9/11 was I got left in the dust. Because I went nowhere. I was a chief for 6 years before 9/11, and I was a chief for more than 10 or 11 years after 9/11. I didn't move. There were guys that were lieutenants when I first made chief that were deputy chiefs when I retired. You know, the guys that went past me, caught me and went past me in rank, which was fine with me because I was not in a competition with anybody. I was very happy in the 18th Battalion. It was a very nice place, plenty of work, great companies, fantastic officers, but 9/11 did that as well. A lot of people, I don't want to say leapfrog because it sounds like I'm saying they did something that they didn't deserve because everybody deserved everything they got. But some people got promoted just a little bit ahead of their time after 9/11 because we had so many vacancies as a result of that tragic incident.
Right, of course. It was the battlefield promotions, as they were called, I think, in the New York Daily News at the time. And battlefield promotions they were. And Mike Thomas just briefly wants to know, where were you that day? Were you on duty or off duty?
No, I was home. I was actually delivering my son, who was now my son is now a firefighter in Wichita, Kansas, which is a fantastic fire department. I've been there a number of times. And he was just a young boy. I was dropping him off at the school bus. I live up in the woods. I have to drive them out to the school bus. And I was getting my car worked on that morning. I was just going to the driving into the repair shop when it happened. All of a sudden, Matty Daly, I don't know if you know Matty Daly. He's a great photographer, takes a lot of pictures in the Bronx. He texted me, and I think Mickey Conboy and a couple other guys what was that called? That direct connect, right? That we used to have on. Yeah. They were all calling me. Hey, chief, the plane hit the World Trade Center. Make a long story short, I ran home and got dressed and went into work. And that was that. I was not working, which worked out real well for me, I think.
Yeah, because, I mean, look, there's a lot of chiefs. I remember this was something that Tommy Richardson told me when he was on the show. Like, you know, in July of 2001, it was a meeting with Chief Nigro. He was still a chief at the time. This was before he became chief of department. And they were basically saying, okay, where do you guys want to go? And Tommy Richardson wanted Manhattan, but that ended up going to Chief Matty Ryan, you know, whereas Richardson was off. Yeah, yeah. Chief Richardson was off that day, as were you. Chief Ryan got Manhattan, but he responded and he got killed that day, sadly. So, yep. You know, yep. You never know. You know, it's just the way. Oh, Jake Richard says Nextel. That's what it was. Nextel.
Oreo Palmer, my buddy Oreo Palmer. We lost him that day.
Yeah.
Made it up to the 86 war.
Him and Ronnie Buca. Him and Ronnie Buca, who, Hanky, obviously you worked with and won. He became a fire marshal later on after a five-story fall he suffered. They called him the Flying Fireman. Those two guys were in great shape. They got all the way up.
And radio transmitted. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great guys. Great guys. And very heroic what they did that day as well. And Hank adds, the good thing about being an FDNY chief is that at a fire, whatever they needed done, got done usually pretty quickly because the guys are well-trained, like you were saying earlier, and competent. That's an excellent
point. You know what? That goes, I shouldn't even say that goes unsaid because you have to say it because it's not true everywhere, but it's true on this job. It's true on the FDNY. I'll tell you what, I didn't have to say anything twice. And half the time I would start a sentence and it was chief, we got it. You know, it might have already been done or maybe already underway. You know, mm-hmm. it was great. It was great. Yep.
Yeah. No, it's a perfect position to be in as a fire officer because even though obviously you never want to get lackadaisical, and that's not saying that any fire officer, yourself included, has, there has to be a sense of like not relaxation. That's not the right word, but a calmness because you know the guys with you. Or the guys that you're going to run into from other companies on that job, like you said, they got it. They know what to do. It's second nature to them.
Right. Yep. And everybody works hard all year, every tour, every shift, their whole career and every rank. I really don't know it. I know they exist somewhere, maybe even on the FDNY. But everybody I ever worked with loved the job, loved training, loved drilling. I love the stories about Rescue 1 and Rescue 2 going out at midnight on winter nights. You know, to do a realistic training drill on a roof of a vacant building in the dark because you can have a run in the middle of the night in the winter, you know, and you have to be able to operate in those conditions. And there are guys that are like, oh, my God, they went out when it was snowing. Yeah, we have fires in the snow occasionally, too, you know. So,
yeah, of course.
And I'm so thankful that the job was like that.
Yeah. No, and there was something that John Vigiano used to do in 2. Where he would take the guys because they had a lot of vacant cars that nobody claimed. They were just there. I don't know if they were stolen or abandoned or whatever. They were just there. And they would go and work on those cars and take them apart to simulate an extrication rescue. And you know what? When it came time to go to a pin job, you know, they knew what to do because they had spent time training and simulating it already. So
we used to do that on the Lower East Side in 11 truck because there was a lot of people would drive down to the Lower East Side to abandon their cars or light them on fire or whatever. And we would see them. And we go out there and cut the roof off and pop the doors and then throw them all inside. Now, the next morning, you're coming into work, and you weren't part of that drill. You're coming into work the next morning on East 3rd Street, and you're like, oh, that car wasn't here the last time I was working. I guess the boys were there last night, you know, and it's all cut up, you know.
Yep, yep. It's all fun and games until somebody says, dude, where's my car? So just a couple of things is, you know, we're at the hour mark, and I know I said I wouldn't keep you too long. You mentioned being an instructor. You're also a writer. You've written 3 books. You've written in the FDNY Training Magazine. You've written in WNYF. So tell me how that came about, because it's one thing to verbalize thoughts on the fire service and transmit them to those that are under you, but it's another thing to write them down. And I remember having this conversation with Paul last year. It's almost harder because, as he joked, you want to make sure you put it in English. So tell me about writing.
And you know what? To some degree, it is harder. But what's easier is you can write and rewrite and edit and look at it and modify it, and then somebody else can look at it and help you with it. When you talk, you talk. It comes out of your mouth sometimes, like a lot of politicians learn the hard way. Sometimes it's hard to take the words back after you say them. But I started writing. Harvey Eisner, God rest his soul, from Firehouse Magazine, he used to write in Rescue 3 when I was a young firefighter there. And eventually he said, hey, why don't you write an article? I'm like, me? He said, yeah, write an article for the magazine. Make a long story short, eventually he sort of talked me into it. I wrote something basic about something I knew, something with the saw. And that led to another article, and I sort of started doing it maybe a couple of times a year. I don't remember the frequency. Eventually, I got promoted lieutenant, and I kept doing that, kept writing articles for him. And then he invited me to go to the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, which was the show, back in the old days of the slides, you know, the little cardboard slides that you had actually put into the round projector and all that. And one thing led to another, led to another. You know, eventually I thought, gee, a book would be interesting. And my first book came via Vinnie Dunn. It was after 9/11. It was 2002. It was published in 2003. A printer went to Vinnie Dunn and said, listen, there's a lot of leadership books out there. Leadership by Robert E. Lee, leadership by Abraham Lincoln, leadership by the Marine Corps. How about a fire service? How about a fire chief's leadership book? And Vinnie Dunn told me, you know what? I'm working on another book right now. I got a lot of books. And he gave them my name. And they came to me and said, would you like to do that? And I did. So that was my first book back in 2003, which is actually still in print. First in, last out, Leadership Lessons from the New York Fire Department. Still one of my most favorite. I enjoy the book. I still like it. And it's one of my most popular books. And then after that, it sort of bit me. I said, oh, that was good. And I always wanted to write an engine book. After I was the captain of 48, you know, go look at all the books that are written. A lot are written about technical rescue and roof operations and truck guys and mustaches and Halligan tools and all the truck stuff. And there's not many engine books written. I said, I want to write an engine book. And I did. And I wrote The Engine Company, which I was happy with the results of that. Then my friend Rick Lasky, a good friend of mine, I travel around and teach with him a lot. He's a retired chief from down in Texas. We wrote a leadership book together, my third book, Five Alarm Leadership, which we both added our 2 cents into it and came out with a nice book. And actually, I just wrote another book and it just came out. I just put it on Facebook the other day. It's called the Fire Scene, and it will be published and available December 20th through Fire Engineering Books. And that is really just an accumulation, a collection of my articles. I write the back page of Firehouse now every month. I've been doing it for almost 20 years. And I took the best and the brightest articles, and I categorized them by topic, and I made, I think, 13 or 14 chapters, and that's the new book. So it gets easier. Like being an officer, it gets easier the more you do it, right?
And I love that, because you know what? Look at that book that Vinny wrote. It says, you said, it's still in print. It's still helping firemen, particularly fire officers now, to where that's the imprint you can leave. A column that you wrote, for example, in 1996 can still be a point of reference now, the same way fast forward 20 years, let's say it's 2042. Okay, that column that Chief Salka wrote in WNYF, we're still using that as a point of reference now, when at that right. point they'll probably have robot fire trucks.
And that was always fun too, writing for WNYF, which I wrote, I'll say, fairly regularly, not all the time, but I don't think too many years went by that I didn't write maybe one article for WNYF, which was great.
I love WNYF.
You know, I branched out into fire engineering a couple of times, and I write for the New York State Chiefs. They have a quarterly magazine. So it's fun to do. It's a bully pulpit. It allows you to put your perspective on paper. And then, you know, those that read it and like it, save it and use it. And those that don't, put it in the birdcage, you know? So
what are you going to do? There you go. And I think the guy that made that cool, before I continue again, he says, I had 2 carousels full of training slides. I wish I still had them.
I guess I'll call carousels. I still have them. They're right under my desk, right behind me. I never turned anything.
There you go. But the guy that made that cool, you know, in terms of being a writer in the fire service that broke the mold, was Dennis Smith. I mean, Dennis Smith really paved the way for so many of you with Report from Engine Company 82 to be able to chronicle what it's like. There you go. There's a man right there. And I miss him.
There he is, Dennis Smith. Great, great guy and a friend. Great yeah. guy.
Yep. Yep. Glad I got the chance to have him on the show before he passed away. You know, that book is the reason why so many of you can feel comfortable and not like fish out of water, putting your thoughts, active or retired, about the fire service out there. It's cool to write about this stuff because not only can it help, it can save lives, not only of the civilians, but also the firemen.
Yeah, suddenly people started paying attention to the fire service other than just the firefighters and the fire buffs, the people that are already interested. Suddenly the general public had a taste for it and said, wow, that's pretty interesting, you know? So, yeah.
A couple more questions. You know, just to go back, speaking of buffs, the buffs, can't speak today. The Bell Club, when they came out with their Valor Award originally in 1984 is where it first began. You were the first guy to win the Valor Award when they started giving it out in 1984. This is when you were at Ladder 11. Tell us the story behind winning it.
Yeah, so that was 11 Truck. I was a pretty fortunate young man to go down to 11 Truck when it was still doing some work. And again, like anybody else who's ever won a medal or been recognized in any way, it's a matter of chance, you know, chance meeting or chance coming together with, you know, ability. You got to be a Bill. You know, you might get the chance. If you don't know what you're doing, it's not going to happen. So if you know what you're doing and you get the opportunity, you work in the right shifts, you make the left instead of the right, boom, you're in the right spot to do something. So it was, you know, it was a Sunday morning in 11 truck. It was a beautiful day, if I remember correctly. And I was on the inside with Charlie Kipp. Charlie Kipp was one of the boss there. Great boss. And we got a box at I was Houston and something. I can't remember the cross street, but it was one of the big intersections. And we went screaming up there. And there was a crowd of people out there. It looked like they were shooting a movie. That's how many people were there watching this fire already when we got there. And we ran up the inside, got to the fire apartment, popped the door, and went inside. And it was, you know, for firefighters that are listening, it was a good job. It was hot and it was smoky, and we were just going by sense of touch. It was a railroad apartment. We made it to the front room. The front room, which was the one that was, you know, opening onto the front fire escape. And Charlie, Lieutenant Kip, went to the left, and I went to the right, and I hit the bed, boom, and I found a little baby, little 2-year-old girl, and I grabbed her, and I screamed to the officer, I got a kid here, and we ran forward. We went to the windows. There were guys on the fire escape. What's his name? There was a guy in the fire escape, the OV. He was venting the windows right then. And we went right there. Actually, I handed the baby out because we had to finish the search of the room. The room was not done yet. And I almost just had his name for a minute. But anyway, Richie Durso. Yeah, he was on the outside fire escape. So he took the baby down the towel ladder. 18 truck was there. They put their towel ladder up. And turns out I was a young man. The division commander wrote a glowing endorsement for it. The fact that I was a young fourth grade firefighter still, right out of 34 engine. And I got the Fireball Club, which was like, I didn't even know they had medals. And all of a sudden I'm getting one. It was a memorable thing. I was pretty proud.
So that brings us back, I guess, to 2012. By this point, it's 33 years. You'd had a great run. You'd done a lot of things. Was it an injury that forced you out? Or did you simply say, you know what? I've had my fun. I've had my fill. It's time to go.
You know what? I got prostate cancer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And yeah, you know what? I was on a plane. I was sitting on a plane getting ready to go somewhere and do a lecture somewhere. And I got a call from the fire department medical office. Hey, Chief Salka, how are you? Good, blah, blah, blah. He said, listen, you just took your fire department medical and your PSA. I didn't even know what a PSA was, right? Your PSA numbers are pretty high. You should really go check that out. Make a long story short, I did. I went to this doctor. Before you know it, they said you got prostate cancer. And, you know, anybody who knows anything about prostate cancer, it's a very slow moving thing, but it can be terrible if you don't deal with it. And there's usually a couple of different options of doing it. So I selected one of the options. And the problem was, if you have your prostate out, at least when I did back then, you couldn't go back to full duty. You can go back to work, but you can't go back to full duty. So I retired. I had 33 years. I had been a chief for 17 years. I was already 50 something years old, 54, I think. So I pulled the plug and I got out and I never looked back. It was a great career. I did 30. It wasn't like it cut it short. I might've stayed a couple more years, but I'm not sure how many more. So yeah, it wasn't anything tragic. It wasn't even really sudden because I was able to go back to work after being diagnosed. I couldn't go back to work after having the surgery, and the surgery was scheduled months ahead of months. So I went back to work knowing when my last shift was going to be. And I had my last night in the firehouse and stuff like that, which I feel fortunate because some guys don't. Some guys slip and take a tumble down the stairs and go to the hospital and then never go back to work. They never knew when their last night was until it was over, you know. So it was, you know, well, maybe a little premature for when I was going to get out anyway, but I can't complain at all. A lot of guys have had worse stories about retirements, you know.
No, and I think that's the most treatable one, thankfully, right? I mean, you'd rather not get it at all, but if you're going to get one, that's exactly
the most treatable. Depending on where it is. Mine was very early, very low numbers. Turns out that the cancer was already out of my prostate, and it was good that I chose the treatment that I had selected. And then you go back, you know, every quarter for a while, and then maybe every 6 months. And now I want a yearly thing. I go back to the doctor every year, and they check it out. They still take your PSA numbers,
okay.
Which was confusing to me. I said, I don't have a prostate. How can I have a PSA number? And the guy said, if we left any of the cancer in you, it will still generate a PSA number if it starts to grow. So that was sort of like sends a telegraph out if it comes back again. So that's not bad, you know. Right. But anyway, yeah, everyone's got a way that they get out of the job. I was happy to get out of the job. Some guys never make it to retirement, you know. So I can't complain.
No, I say this ad nauseum, you know, talking with PD and FD guys that say, I wish I would have stayed longer. To your point, you know, if you can make that walk down to the pension section, that's a good thing, because there's plenty of guys and gals that unfortunately never get to.
Yep. You know, and now my goal is to have the big, long pension, too, you know, the big, long retirement, you know.
Mm-hmm. Keep collecting those checks. As Coop says, I'm getting salty. Keep collecting those checks. This has been a lot of fun. We'll end, as we always end, with the rapid fire segments. 5 hit-run questions from me, 5 hit-run answers from you. You can say pass if you want. Are you ready?
Say again?
5 hit-run. I know I said a little fast. My apologies. It's the rapid fire segment. 5 hit-run questions from me, 5 hit-run answers from you. You can say pass.
All right. Go ahead.
All right. There we go. First, funniest colleagues you have colleagues you ever worked with.
Funniest. Oh, you know what? I know who that was, too. I'm trying to remember his name. First of all, I worked with the biggest collection of comedians. Every place I ever went to, it seems like they must have advertised for funny guys. Every place I went to had some of the funniest guys. And I can't even name anybody right now, but there was some. Patty Barr was a funny guy. In fact, Patty Barr is pretty well known, too. Mm-hmm. Not for being funny, but for other stuff that great stuff he did. But Patty Barr was a funny guy. I can mention him, yeah.
Second, I'm laughing because of course I said it so fast the first time. Richie Dumick, when he was on the show, he's like, I love your show off the air. It was like, you talk so fast sometimes, like, slow down. It's like you're selling me a car. So there you go. There you go, Lieutenant Dumick. I apologize for that. Second, funniest call you ever responded to?
Funniest call? Gosh. You know, some of the things that we think are funny are not funny. So that's
okay.
That's the first problem. Sometimes people's oddball situations that to them still seem like an emergency. I mean, we treat it professionally, but you know, you giggle on the way back to the firehouse sometimes. You know, we had a couple of calls where people got stuck inside doorways or on toilet bowls and stuff like that. But most of the calls I went to were unfortunately not funny. But
that's okay. Third, best advice anyone ever gave you?
Best advice anybody ever gave me. You know, And I can tell you what that advice is, because I gave it to a lot more people. I passed it on, and I'm sure they got it from somebody else before them. Is, you know what? When you're at work, you're at work. You know, answer this question after the question about what was the funniest guy and what was the funniest thing you saw. You know, funny stuff does happen, but it's not funny. You know, particularly when you make officer, you got to be serious. You got to pay attention to what's going on. I remember one time – I forget what that contest was, what it was when they were dumping water on people for a bet or something like
that. Ice bucket challenge.
Huh? Right? And then I remember there was a towel ladder somewhere that made the news. There was a towel ladder where they were dumping water. And then somebody else did the towel ladder, except guess what they did? They accidentally hit a wire with the towel ladder, and they did some severe damage to the apparatus. And I'm saying to myself, you see, that's what happens when you start mixing playing with fire trucks and playing with gear. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you want to play, go play somewhere. But when you're at the firehouse, and I don't mean not a little kidding around for a probie or hitting a probie with a bucket of water in the firehouse on his first day, not stuff like that. But there was a million-dollar apparatus that got damaged because they were playing with some water game, you know, and they weren't paying attention to what they were supposed to do. So the best advice I got was pay attention to what you're doing and remember you're not home and you're not at the club. You're at work. That was the best advice I ever gave, and I gave it to a lot of people.
There you go. Actually, you know what? I was going to ask a different question for the fourth one, but I'll let Rob Procaccini's question take place here before I do. Hank says, Patty Barr made the second roof rope rescue with Kevin Shea.
Absolutely. Yep.
So a good thing, Patty Barr.
Well, I'm going to tell you another Patty Barr story that's funny. After I just told you to be serious, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm in Rescue 3, and some probies come. I think they were assigned to the engine. You know, I think they still do that in the job now. I think the probies still report to the firehouse one day with their gear and stuff, and so this probie comes, and they send him upstairs after talking to him downstairs. They said, go upstairs and talk to the lieutenant. I'm trying to remember the lieutenant's name that was working that day. He was an older Irish guy. He had the brogue and everything else. When I was in Rescue 3, he was in 93 engine. Great, great guy. And he was working. So they send this probie up there. And a bunch of us, the bunk room wasn't far away. We were watching and listening to what happened. So the probie gets to the 93 engine door, and he knocks on it. And it's Patty Barr inside. And he yells, hold on, I can hardly tell the story properly without using all the words that we use, but you can imagine the words, right? He said, hold on, and I'll deal with you in a minute. And then he starts yelling at the guy that he's with inside. And if you ever do that again, I'm going to do this and this. And now get out of here. And he throws him out. The door comes swinging open. A fireman comes running out with a look of terror on his face. Patty Barr comes to the door. He's got a lieutenant shirt on. Who the H are you? Get in here. He brings his probie in. Give me 20 right now. He's down there doing push-ups. And where do you come from? Long Island. Oh, you're one of them guys on Long Island. And he was racing up and down this guy. This guy was sweating bullets. And all of a sudden, the lieutenant came walking up with his cup of coffee. What you doing, Patty? Patty, what you doing in my office with that shirt on? And he blew the whole thing. This probie didn't even realize that it was Patty Barr. He was busting his chops. You know, it was a pretty funny story. Pretty funny story.
Oh, man. Is he still around?
Patty Barr? He's retired. I don't know where he is. I mean, is he on Earth? I think he's still alive, sure.
I'll have to try to get him on this show then.
Oh, and you have to get him on. Patty Barr's a character.
And there you go. I'll have to try to reach out. Rob Procaccini, he'll take the fourth question in this rapid fire. It's a good one. What companies did the chief work in have the best cooks?
Oh, God, I couldn't tell you because you can write this down. John Salka never cooked a meal, not once, in the firehouse. Wow. Not once. Now, I have peeled a million potatoes. I have cut 1,000 onions. I've done everything there is to do to help in the kitchen, but I've never cooked. I'm an eater. Now,
same.
I never had a bad meal, so I can't tell you who the best cook was, although there was a guy in 28 Engine when I was in 11 Truck, Frank. Oh, God, what was his name? Frank. Oh, God, was he a good cook? He always had a little bottle of wine there, too, you know? I mean, you know, for the food, not the drink. And he was quite the cook. You got some nice, fancy Italian meals out of him. Yeah.
And the fifth and final question, the rapid fire. If you can go back in time, knowing what you know now, and give advice to a younger version of yourself, what advice would you give a young John Salka just out of the Probie Academy, just coming onto the FDNY?
You know, this is old advice. It's written in stone somewhere, you know. Just go to a firehouse. Pay attention to everything you're doing. Don't sit down. Don't talk unnecessarily. Treat everybody with respect. Say yes, sir, and say no, sir. Open a door for people. Be polite to civilians on runs. I mean, this is all stuff your mother and father probably should have taught you, but that's the advice I give to people, you know. I see that all going out the window. I don't think I've heard a human say sir or ma'am in 5 years or maybe 10 years. You know, and then you watch like Yellowstone or you watch one of these old movies on TV and you see some people doing it and you sort of miss it. That's my advice. You know, just be polite, be friendly, stay into the job, pay attention to what you're doing. Remember, you're at work, like I said before. It's really not that hard.
Simple advice, but it still applies, like you said. Thank you very much, Chief. This was great. Stick around. We'll say goodbye off the air. Before I say goodbye to the audience, is there any shout out to anyone or anything that you would like to give?
Just to my buddy Rick Lasky, who I travel with all the time, and we do old school together. We have our own little podcast that we do old school, and we talk about old school stuff. And he's out giving a seminar to some volunteer fire department down in Texas tonight that did a favor for him, and he's giving them a seminar on the arm.
All right, there you go. So shout out to him, and shout out to everybody that tuned in tonight. And thanks, guys, for your great questions. Like I said, you really helped me out a lot tonight.
Oh, the question, and I love seeing them on the screen. That was great.
Yeah, no, the chat did its thing tonight, so thank you, guys. I won't shout out to all of you because I don't want to miss anybody, but thank you very much.
Thanks, Hank, for the questions. Yep.
Thank you, Hank. Appreciate you tuning in. Before we go, just a little bit of a sad, you know, on a sad note, I don't mean to end this way, but just a little nod to the New Haven Fire Department. They buried a fireman today who was killed off duty in an auto accident on the highway. A young guy, he was a rookie. So unfortunately, Commissioner Zaslavsky, who's an assistant commissioner with the New Haven Fire Department, made mention of that. And I didn't want to forget to mention him. Thomas Mieles, I think was his name, and just trying to help out at the scene of an auto accident off duty. Unfortunately, was struck and killed. So just a little shout out to the New Haven Fire Department tonight. You're definitely in our thoughts, as is his family. Coming up next on the Mike New Haven podcast, like I said, Friday, it's going to be an interesting show. I've been working to get this guy on for a while. He's a big supporter of the show. Interesting guy, 21 years in the NYPD, retired as a sergeant, and has been just as active in the private sector, bodyguard to the stars, the whole nine. So he'll be here. Mark Mulis is his name, on Friday. And then Monday, another volume 28 of the E-Men inside the NYPD's emergency service unit. It's going to be Ken Schnetzler, another former transit rescue cop who went over to Truck 10 with the merge of NYPD, ESU, of course, with Transit Rescue and Housing Rescue in 1995. In the meantime, on behalf of retired Chief John Salka, this has been volume 33, The Best of the Bravest, Interviews with the FDNY's Elite. I'm Mike Colon, and we will see you next time. Have a great night, everyone. Stay safe.